So hey, Gordon, as far as an update to you guys that is not related to anything we've been talking about, there was a chemical plant that exploded in West Houston today, and they've put out like a notice for like everybody to shut down like their HVAC systems. So I am without air conditioning right now. So again, hopefully it doesn't get too hot. Yeah.
Jeez. Dude, you can't win, man.
I'm built for it, dude.
So when he's just like sweating halfway through,
be like, yeah, I'm gonna make sure to not stand up so you guys can't see like my shirt sweating through like my abdominals. Where's this?
Everyone wants to see your sweaty midriff, Mike.
No, they don't. It's hairy.
Oh, even better. Hairy midriff.
Nothing like a happy trail.
Just like I like my women.
Somebody just went from 6 to midnight.
Hey, I will take the flattery. But that's all I'm taking. Just so we're clear.
As well.
Yeah, I'm pulling her right now. Let's see.
Dude, I'm getting excited about all this shit, man. Like, I'm most excited for the Brave Mission stuff, like whenever that paperwork is done.
Yeah, it's
tell the government to like do its job. And
well, it was actually LegalZoom that dropped the ball a couple times on this thing, man. They are, I'll tell you what,
shocker.
Yeah, all right. Here is the link for YouTube. Never mind.
We need to get, as guests, we need to get Mickey Koss and we need to get Gary K on here, and then when. Also, I don't know if you saw it earlier, but we were talking about the Brave Mission in way more detail about all the stuff that we're stewing up here.
Yeah. Absolutely. Oh, dude. What's going on, Preston?
Hey, guys. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we got a little bit of a return on that end.
Yeah, I've got a... I got to figure out why this is not coming... The sound is not coming back through my mixer.
Well, we've got two guys that have experience with mixers.
But I saw you were having a little issue earlier with John. What was it, John Ballas earlier today too? Huh?
How about now? This is not coming through my. Well, no, it is coming through my audio there.
I think.
How about now? Are you guys getting it? There's no echo
on that. Yep.
Sounds great.
Good. Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah.
Yep.
Good. Yeah. Oh, okay. All right. Perfect.
Hey, you guys just hear us okay?
Yeah, doing great.
Dude, doing good. Hey, I was going to say, we are live on Spaces already, and YouTube is kind of behind the scenes, like a starter for the show where everybody just kind of talks freely and all that fun stuff. And so we've kind of chatted behind the scenes here. We kind of understand through Mike's direction where not to go and all that fun stuff tonight. So definitely appreciate that side of it. And we'll try to keep it fun and light and all that fun
stuff. We'll keep it above the waist.
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about, right?
I'm reposting the link to this. So
it is an adult show, though. Oh,
yeah. Okay. Well, I'm ready.
And so thank you for coming on. We hope we don't damage your reputation too badly.
Too much. Yeah, cheers.
No, looking forward to it. Looking forward to it.
All right.
Oh, boy.
Feel free to grab a bottle of bourbon.
Where do you live in?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Where are you from and where do you live now?
So I'm originally from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I don't talk about where I live.
That's a smart move. Very smart move.
Almost got him.
Yeah, that one's not hard.
I tell you what, though. I was listening to your book about West Point a little bit today while I was rucking. You know, perfect book to listen to while you're rucking, by the way. You're going through suffering and listening to the hilarious, laughy stories coming from West Point. But, dude, That book's pretty good, man. I gotta tell you, because it's like the chapters are structured like similarly to actually like the old school South Park episodes. Like you get the good dose of laughs and funny, but then there's a nice little life lesson at the end of it, the bluff section. So I applaud you on that. That was a well done book.
I appreciate it, Mike. Yeah, no, it's funny. I wrote that so long ago. Geez, I probably wrote that in 2007. I want to say 2008, somewhere in that time frame. And it was just, I wanted to kind of like capture some of the funny stories, like while it was still fresh in my head, kind of coming out of the service academy 5-6 years before that point in time. And I knew if I didn't like write it down, I probably wouldn't be able to, you know, tell my kids some of the stories. So it was just something fun for me to do. And just kind of, I tried to do it in a fun way so that it wasn't boring, but it was actually some of the more humorous things that happened to me and things that, you know, were a little embarrassing or whatever. So yeah, it was fun.
Well, I think I could see how maybe people that don't have like a military experience may not see it necessarily as funny, but as a guy going through the enlisted side,
yeah,
like it was not only nice to know that you guys got a very similar experience to what we did,
yeah,
but then just being like the media and Hollywood gives like such like a relatively bad rap to drill sergeants. Like everybody thinks they're just assholes. Yeah. But after you go through like the first couple of weeks, like I don't know about the rest of you guys, but I was poking fun at my sergeants just to like see what I could get smoked with. Cause then it gets to the point of where you're poking fun with them and they realize that they can't, like you're one of the guys that they can't smoke into like,
yeah. Oh, I can't fuck with this guy.
Yeah. And then you end up becoming just like buddy buddy with them by the time the like basic's done.
Yeah.
It was nice.
Yeah, I think that's something that's lost on a lot of people is like you do garner a kinship with these people that are kind of putting you through these difficult trials and tribulations. And you know, I think that the thing that looking back at that whole experience, because for like us, like the mental, it was much more mental, at least it was for me, way more mental than it was physical for that first year. And the thing that I really took away from it is you're getting this sense or this this seed planted in your brain that I can truly accomplish whatever, and hardship is something that can always be overcome. And I don't know. It's much more teaching a person that they can do a whole lot more than what they think they can, and it's almost 99% of it upstairs as opposed to like physically what you thought you could do. And so it's something that I would never want to go through again, but it's something that I would probably not trade for anything else that I went through it.
Yeah. I feel the same way. It's like I think that was probably the biggest learning thing going through basic was that, oh yeah, this sucked, but I assumed it was going to suck a lot more. Right. Like it's fascinating how the human brain will just not only expect the absolute most egregious suffering that you could possibly imagine, but then it's also going to extrapolate that into perpetuity until the environment changes. And then you realize once you get across that line, it's like, oh, that relief was really quick. Okay. Yeah. Well, that wasn't that bad.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. It was just, it's a very unique experience for anybody to actually submit themselves to that. The other thing too, is it's just like, you get very comfortable just owning up to things. And you see this throughout society where nobody wants to ever admit that they could do something wrong or that like, oh yeah, you know what? That was my bad. I take full responsibility for that. I should have done a better job. And I find a lot of folks that have gone through that experience are much more prone or much more inclined to just admit like, yeah, just like I see it with kids, right? It's like, well, did you mess up or, well, it was so-and-so's fault. Like you see so many adults today in our culture that just like refuse to admit that they could have possibly done anything wrong, where it's just like, you can just move on with life so much faster when you just raise your hand, say, yeah, that was me. I messed up. I could have done a better job. So, let's, you know, if we want to talk about how I could have improved that more, let's go ahead and do it. If not, let's move on to the next thing and learn from that. But the military like jams that down your throat in a good way, that you have to start thinking and acting in that manner, or you'll just get annihilated.
Well, like you won't make it. Right.
Yeah. They used to. Yeah.
Good point. I mean, the other part about that I think is interesting is it teaches you start to develop an awareness of how your actions impact everybody else around you.
Mm-hmm.
It's very useful.
Yes.
You start to become a lot more cognizant of like, okay, well, if I do this stupid thing, I'm going to screw up all my buddies here. And that's not
true. Yeah. I mean, I remember this one's cruel. I remember as a cadet, and don't laugh too hard, but as a cadet, platoon sergeant, I had a guy that, was not shining his shoes. Just like you'd show up to formation. Everybody else is like, at least, I mean, they sucked, but like they were trying. You could tell they were trying, which is pretty much what you're going for. But there was a guy that just like was not doing it. So it was like, all right, hey, come up here, stand in front of the formation. Everybody's going to do push-ups except for you. And you're going to count them off for everybody in the platoon that is like shining their shoes. And like for people that like aren't in the military, they'd be like, what the hell is that? Right? Like the idiot that's not doing the job should be the one punished. But no, you like punish the whole rest of the team, because they need to collectively as a group work together and get in unison and help that dude out to realize that was important for them to all be, you know, working towards the same thing. And just, it's things like that like you just kind of go through and you think about teams and moving as an organization collectively very differently when you go through those types of experiences, and definitely when you lead those types of experiences, to kind of see the interplay between them. Because surprise, the next day that guy had some pretty shiny shoes and like the group was like, right. Weird. Anyway.
Well, it's I think this is a pretty good setup for, we're going to have some good rants about all the issues with the US.
Let's do it. You guys ready to go?
Let's go. Yeah, I'm ready to get fired up. Let's do this intro.
Here. Welcome to Bitcoin Veterans. I am super excited. Yeah, hands up. We are Bitcoiners. We're veterans. This is really easy to explain. It's easy enough for crayon eaters like myself. We do this every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Tonight, we are joined by Army Captain, West Point grad, aerospace engineer, pilot, author, podcaster, everybody's nightmare to compete with in terms of a college roommate or somebody that you knew once upon a time. The one and only Preston Pish joins us here on Bitcoin Veterans tonight. Welcome, sir. How are you?
This is long overdue, and I appreciate the invite and being included. The intro, can I just say, that was really impressive. Like, I've been doing podcasting for like a decade, and we don't have anything like that. That was pretty awesome. I'm very impressed.
We know some guys. So
I know some guys named Shane.
Yeah. Long overdue. I mean, we had to really kind of iron out the first 20 shows to get to this point. You know, we're like, yeah, you know, like we'll do some stuff here and there. And we've had some fun times and had some great guests. But I think this is one that I think we're all going to remember. We really appreciate, you know, you're a busy man and having the time to come in here and hang out with the plebs and have a good time with what we're doing as Bitcoin veterans. Kind of go through this in the beginning of every show. We just kind of do the mission statement where we let people know kind of why we're doing this and what this is all about. So Bitcoin veterans, ladies and gents, this is a show for anybody that once upon a time signed a contract that said you can take everything, including my life and my rights and everything else. that was really sold on the idea of what America is or was, and the idea of freedom and liberty and self-sovereignty, you know, custody in your own life. Those were the things that I think most of us were born and bred to, that did sign that contract, and to restoke that spirit, to re-energize people, to give them mission and purpose. We're here for that with Bitcoin now as veterans, and I think there's a whole host of a wealth of knowledge, not only within this group, ever expanding group, I should say, to get on this mission. But it's something that we take a lot of pride in, and we're really happy you're here.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here, and just honored to be with you guys, because we share a very common a mission, purpose, and what we think the world can become. And I think that's why we all originally kind of raised our hands and took the oath. And you know, as the environment changes, so do the way we kind of approach our lives and what we stand for. And I think that over the, you know, since 2008, there's something that has drastically changed the environmental settings as to what this world is moving towards. And I think we all know what that is. And it's no surprise to me that veterans are getting Bitcoin at a very fast pace. It just makes total sense to me.
Yeah, it's happening. And this thing that's kind of just started, you know, we've just threw it together. Just a couple of us were like, hey, let's start this thing. It is rapidly taken on a life of its own and is accelerating now. Very quickly. I think there are already a lot of veterans actually in Bitcoin who just didn't really talk about it so much, and we're finding each other through this. Mm-hmm. As well as, you know, the thing is, we say this is for veterans, but it's also for active duty. Anybody even who is a Bitcoiner or even Bitcoin curious, bring them in. Let's get them in these groups and get them organized and get them moving all in the same direction. And it's just a fascinating thing to watch happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know about you guys, but Preston, I got two questions in particular for you just to get the conversation rolling.
Yeah.
One would be, how did you come around to the whole investing space? Because I've listened to a lot of your stuff like over the years, and I haven't maybe I have heard it and I don't necessarily remember it. But how did you get here? Right. Because you've talked a lot about like Warren Buffett and studying him in particular and all that stuff. How did you get to like being so well educated and so well versed on like the debt markets? Because like everybody wants to get your opinion on like the debt markets and the debt spiral and all that. But I want to know how you got here. And then also I would like to know, how did you come to Bitcoin and which came first?
Yeah. So, very simply, I've always been fascinated with markets. I found them to be extremely like just so many variables and just really complex. And I've been attracted to the mathematical complexity of financial valuation.
Okay.
So like my undergrad aerospace engineering is very math heavy. And so even as a brand new lieutenant in the Army, like I was very interested in financial markets even back then and studied them. I mean, you could talk to people that I was a platoon leader with, and I was always there with like a stock investing book reading like on my time off. And so, I mean, you can see the books through the years that I've read.
You got a small collection. Yeah.
For me, I've always just tried to be reading about markets, about business. I don't read fiction. I'll watch movies, but I don't read fiction. I read nonfiction, and it's almost always business oriented, for whatever reason. I just love it. So for two decades, I was just consuming as much in anything I could get my hands on. And very early, I just always kind of had the opinion, like, why am I going to read a book from some, you know, some person that went on CNBC and has like no proven track record of performance. Yeah. I'm not going to read their book. I'm going to read the book of the person who has proven that they have been able to amass at least $1 billion. And more importantly, what books did they read that allowed them to gain the insights and the intelligence that they have? And then what I want to do is I want to read every one of those books. I want to read, I want to study them. I wanted to study their decision-making. And it was more, I guess, for me, I just looked at it as freedom. Like if I could invest in a way that allowed me to outperform markets and be able to amass a higher net worth, well, then I can call the shots and I don't have to answer it. And so maybe some of it is, you know, deep down the cognitive, like psychological train, maybe some of it was in the military, you're always answering to somebody. You're all in. I mean, I went to West Point right out of high school. And so I left this household where I'm answering to parents. Then I'm always answering to somebody else. And there was always some type of pecking order that I had to respond to. And I was never like autonomous to like literally be free to do whatever I want. So for me, I'm looking at financial markets. And I'm saying, hey, if I can make enough money, I'll never have to answer to anybody. I can just answer to myself.
Hell yeah.
And so some of it was that, just kind of like reading as much as I possibly could, because I like the only way you're going to be able to outsmart or maneuver the masses, which everybody's competing in this free and open market, is you have to have an intellectual advantage over them. And so for me, it was always just like, oh, well, the only way that I'm going to get that intellectual advantage over somebody is I have to go to the most intellectually dense individuals, study the living hell out of them, and study who they studied. And then that's going to give me the intellectual density to outperform everybody else. So So I'm in, I was in my, second rotation into Afghanistan. And I was talking to a warrant officer, CW5 pilot, Apache pilot. And we were sitting there in Kandahar, and we were just talking about financial markets. And I told the guy, I was like, I would love to just write a book about finance. And I said, but there's no way I could do it, because like nobody would ever read it. Like, it's like, who's going to read a book from some soldier that's like flying Apache helicopters on finance, right? I was like, but I think I have like some like really keen or interesting insights. Particularly, I was like really hardcore Warren Buffett at this point, and had consumed, you know, security analysis. I could go find my security analysis back there, and like the whole book is tabbed, highlighted. It's ridiculous. And the book isn't even, like, in the grand scheme of things, like there's way better books, especially for like today's markets, than security analysis, which is like this giant tomb of you know, what Warren Buffett claims is the book by Benjamin Graham that, you know, gave him all of his, a majority of his investing prowess or insights. And most of the book is about fixed income. A lot of it's about fixed income and preferred stock. And, you know, the tail end of it, the last 30% of it's about equity, or 40% of it's about equity. And, you know, so it another thing that I think I learned back then, I know this is a really long answer, and I'll get back to the story. I'll get back to the story about the Warren officer that kind of told me, gave me the inspiration to actually action it. But when I was going through a lot of it, Buffett had always claimed that you had to understand how to value fixed income before you could actually value equity. And so this was something that I had never been trained or gone to, I use the word train, I'd never gone to school for business at all. It was always engineering. But I really dove deep into kind of that statement that you had to understand how to value fixed income. And so I started like literally programming my own. I didn't know what the calculations were for like valuing a bond, but I was doing internet searches and trying to understand it. And like, how does that change? And reading different books like The Bond Book and trying to understand that. And then like, once I wrapped my head around those variables, I was kind of like reverse engineering how I would value equity or a stock based off of those bond equations. not even realizing that there was like free cash flow, like IRR calculations that they teach in business schools or anything. So like for me, that was really important, like that I was deriving the calculations myself before being taught in school, because it forced me to think from a first principle standpoint on like, well, why would you value the free cash flows of the company this way? Almost like they're receipts of a coupon on a bond.
Yeah.
And I realized real fast, like, okay, equity doesn't have a maturity date like a bond has, which makes it very different. And so like, how do I value the rest of the tail? Like if it's a 10-year bond, like those coupons stop after 10 years. So like equity, it's not like that. So like all of these things as an engineer, I'm like trying to dissect and like break all that down. And so I had done this prior to this engagement that I had with this warrant officer in Afghanistan. So he's just asking me like basic questions. I'm explaining it to him. And he's like, I don't know this stuff, but it really does sound like you know what you're talking about. You should write the book. And I was like, yeah, I know, but like who the hell is going to buy it? And he's like, well, maybe your thing is that you're not from Wall Street and like that could sell the book. And I was like, yeah, maybe. I didn't know. I was because I was so naive, that was actually a huge advantage, because if I would have known like what it took to kind of like break through on some of this stuff, I probably would have never taken the first step. Because it is such a grind, and creating a brand or this, to become a quote unquote subject matter expert, like it really takes a lot to kind of like, it is just pure persistence. There's so much, and you have to kind of know what you're talking about. Yeah. So, but long story short, he encouraged me to write this. I wrote it, and this is just when like Kindles were coming out, a few years before, but you were able to put hyperlinks into Kindles. And I got this idea is like, well, hold on, I could make some YouTube videos, which was also something that was brand new at this point in time. Like,
oh, look at you, you little innovator.
Very new. And I was like, maybe I could make videos that kind of explain and walk a person through graphically how to calculate the value of a bond, or how to calculate the value of preferred stock, or how to calculate the value of a stock, a common stock. And so I built these videos on YouTube, and then I hyperlinked them into the Kindle. And then I went on Amazon and I was selling the Kindle for like nothing. All I wanted to do was get readership through it, because I felt like if people would see it and like watch these videos, that it would kind of spread and kind of do its thing. And like, that's how I initially got into a lot of this.
Damn. Okay. That was definitely nothing that I had ever heard before. So I appreciate that. So like, and after this question, guys, I'll stop so you guys can ask him questions, but where does the Bitcoin trail start?
Yeah. So this one's really interesting, especially in light of the last 2 days for me. I'm reading this book called The Firm, The Fund, that just came out yesterday. I'm almost done with it. Let me see here. I've got 1 hour and 30 minutes left.
It just came out yesterday. I'm almost done with it.
I've been
two books a day
aggressively going through this book. I basically spent my whole day reading this book. It's about Ray Dalio and it's about Bridgewater. Oh. And my God, it's like, it is a straight sniper shot straight to his head. This book. It is brutal. It is by Rob Copeland, is the author.
So is it kind of like poking at Ray Dalio as far as like the principles? Yes. Book and everything?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I would enjoy that book.
Yeah, it's because I'll tell you, I came to Bitcoin. I will put this out there, regardless of when anybody thinks of Ray Dalio, especially after reading that book, you probably won't have a good opinion of Ray Dalio. But Ray's video, The Economic Machine, which they also talk about in this book, was very influential for me, because as a hardcore Warren Buffett person for years, Dalio's framework was really kind of like really bucking that whole value investing, like ignore macro, gold is worthless narrative. And you do need to understand currencies because they do fail. And it was Tony Robbins and some others that like really caused me to really deep dive on the Ray Dalio's approach, well, this risk parity approach that Dalio implements, and his economic machine video, which I think came out in 2014. I'm watching it like as all that's coming out, I'm watching that. There's the book. Oh, wow. Look how low the reviews. I would give it a much higher review than that. It is very entertaining.
It's only 7 ratings.
It's a very entertaining book.
We'll fix that.
You heard him, guys. Go out there and buy it and do a review.
Literally buying it right now.
Well, I think for some people they might read it and they think that they might say, well, this is really biased against Ray. And you know, I've met Ray. I don't know Ray. I've met him, but I don't know him. And I feel like I owe a lot to Ray because through his writing, through the things that I've studied about Ray, it led me to Bitcoin. And it led me to Bitcoin because he writes about currency failures, and he writes about how it's important to have a mix of gold, a small mix of gold in your portfolio to guard against currency failures. And then his economic machine talks about these long-term credit cycles, which I think is a very valid thing. And it's something that I hadn't read anywhere before that talked to this idea of like this 80-year credit cycle and it coming to a head. I don't agree with this beautiful deleveraging thing that he talks about at the end of the video, but that's beside the point. The idea was something that I absolutely got from Ray Dalio, which allowed me to look at Bitcoin and say, this is how all of this is going to get resolved. Like this global fiat debacle that is, you know, coming to a head on a grand global scale. I think Bitcoin is the thing that's going to resolve that. I would have never seen that if it wasn't for Ray Dalio. So it's kind of bittersweet for me because I'm like reading this book. And I mean, he comes through as such a douchebag in this book. I mean, truly, like when you read this, you're just gonna be like, this guy is the epitome of like a leader that is just a disaster.
Oof.
And oof. Truly. But you know, it doesn't but I say that all in the same breath of I feel like I owe a lot to the guy because he allowed me to see this thing back in 2015 is whenever I, you know, initially took a Bitcoin position. That's when we did our very first show on Bitcoin, was early 2015, I want to say. And so, yes, when I saw it, I immediately bought it. I was like, hey, this has a, you know, when you're investing, you want to find things that have an asymmetric return, and you want to buy something that that you think that the fundamental, I don't know how to turn that off. Again, my technical failures.
If you do this, it'll do firework for you.
Will it?
Or there it goes.
How do you turn this off?
We found it by mistake.
And it's not Zoom. Like we're using this StreamYard right now. It's like a different thing. I don't know how to turn it off. If somebody knows how to turn that off, can you hit me up on Twitter or something? But where was I at? I was talking about Ray, and then
successfully derailed everything.
That's what we do here at Bitcoin Veterans.
Put him on the spot and then try to have him answer questions with, you know, interruptions. You were kind of just leading us down that last bit of kind of coming into Bitcoin with it.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, like I would have never seen this large long-term credit cycle without Ray. So like I have an enormous amount of debt of gratitude to this guy. But at the same time, like I would have never wanted to work at Bridgewater after reading this book. Like I have worked around people that are just toxic leaders. Like I'm sure anybody in the military has. Like it's the epitome of like a toxic culture from what I'm reading in this book.
Wow.
What would you say is your, I think most, let's just say most impactful book or author, and what was the reason that maybe it stirred something in you? Like, hey, if you had to say, hey, young guy, like here's the first book, maybe if you're getting into the space, you want to do big things, this is the author you need to read.
For Bitcoin specifically?
Oh, I mean, just economics, finance. I don't care if it's Mises, Rothbard, Austrians, if it's Bitcoin, whatever your choice.
Oh, yeah. Basic Economics is a good book. That's by Sowell. If you're looking at, because it's just, it's much more, it's going to give you the right foundation of like how to think about markets. He is so matter of fact and first principled in his thinking and the way that he lays things out, which I think is lost on so many business schools and economists these days. When I think Economic Calculation is just vital. So like Margin of Safety is a book, Seth Klarman's book, is probably the best value investing book out there. You know, like Buffett says it's security. It's definitely not security analysis. but it Margin of Safety, I would say, is probably one of the best books that you can get out there. Now, you like you're looking at it right there, and that's not Seth's book. No, that's Paul Jones. Yeah, that's not Seth's book. I don't even think you can buy Seth's book. I think you can only download the PDF at this point. There it is, right there. Margin of Safety. Risk averse value investing strategies for
yeah, you can't buy it.
Yeah, you can't buy it.
Oh, it's for $3,000.
So it's not $3,000. You can go online and you can buy the PDF, or you can download the PDF for free. And I would encourage people to download the PDF for free, because I think part of Seth's I've heard part of his part of the reason you can't buy the book is because he understands scarcity, and he understands that if his book isn't, if you can't buy it anywhere, the value of it shoots up, and it's basically like marketing and whatever, because it's so expensive. Everybody's like, oh my God, that book's $5,000 for just the used copy. But you can go, it's freely, it's all over the internet. You can download the PDF.
That's what Jason Lowry's up to.
He might be.
I figured it out.
Yeah, he might be. I've got a copy over there. You better believe I wouldn't sell
it. I'm going to put it on Amazon right now for $3,000. Let's go.
it may, you know, as Bitcoin continues to value itself, if he does not publish that in print anymore, I think you would see that happen to the value of that book.
Yeah.
Just because of the scarcity of it. Yeah. But yeah, so anyway, that book, I would argue from an if you truly want to understand economic calculation of equity, that's probably the best book you could ever read. It's a PDF. It's free. Go download it. And if Seth's a billionaire, so like, I don't think he's too concerned about a couple book sales. even at $3,000 a book, I think he could care less.
That must be nice.
It's still brilliant though.
Yeah.
Little scarcity thing.
Yeah. From a, you know, it really depends on like what we're talking about from like what I would recommend for books. But, Ray's book, I think Ray's book on, his credit cycle book, I forget the big debt cycles, I think is the name of it, is really good. Just kind of laying out the historical of all these, various long-term credit cycles and how they go bust, and like what happens to those countries as that happens, is really great. Another book on Bitcoin. Did I say Lynn Alden's book, Broken Money, for Bitcoin books? No,
but that is so, a great.
That's Ray's book, The Big Debt Crisis. I think it's very good. So from a Bitcoin standpoint, I would say two books for sure is Lynn's Broken Money and Saifedean's The Bitcoin Standard are two very, very good books. Those come with a very financial slant to them. So like I obviously like talk about finance. So like both of those books kind of come at Bitcoin from a very financial standpoint. I know Jimmy Song, like if maybe you're into coding and more on the software engineering side, Jimmy Song's book is really good. Can't remember the title. I think it's just called Bitcoin. You can type in Jimmy Song.
Ruins everything, right? This one.
That's the latest one.
No. I'm saying more from like a software engineering standpoint. If you pull up his, just type in Jimmy Song on Amazon, and then I can, if you have it displayed there, I can tell you which one it is.
Working on it now.
I'm wondering how I think some of these books would be really great to hand off to some of the older generation that I think we're going to see coming into the space in this next run, because you're going to have these ETFs coming out, it seems like. And
that's it right there. Programming Bitcoin. This is down and dirty into the code, so that if people, like, if you're an engineer and you want to wrap your head around like why Bitcoin, how does it actually work? Like, show me the lines of code. I want to dig really deep on this thing. Then that's a book for that type of person.
Fascinating. I did not know that book was out there. Huh. So I have a question for you, unless Jordan, unless you had a question for him that's along the same lines.
Well, my question was more like, I feel like, so I've given kind of a normie friend who's a little older, the Bitcoin Standard, and he read it and liked it. He's not like a Bitcoiner. I'm wondering, I feel like now with the ETF stuff, he's talked to me a little bit more about it. And I've kind of talked to him. I was like, hey, don't like, just put in like 5% of your portfolio or whatever. Like, that's not financial advice, but like, you know, transfer some of the things that aren't performing into that. And then let me know what you think. I wonder if I gave him a copy of Broken Money, would that be a good book to continue to try to orange pill him? Or are there some other books you'd recommend for that kind of scenario? I don't know if you've tried to orange pill.
And you, like, and you said that he did go through Safe's book.
Yeah, he read it.
Yeah.
He actually convinced me that it's more likely that Bitcoin would become a global reserve asset. And so when he told me that, I was like, oh, that's an interesting take. Let me think on that some more.
So I don't know what he's necessarily meaning on the terminology difference by saying it would be a global reserve asset versus whatever other terminology. Like, for me, it's just going to become the global settlement layer. It's going to be global money, right? And we can call it whatever we want in between. Like, if we want to call it a digital commodity in the meantime, as it works its way to becoming global money, sure. Yeah. But I think a lot of it is from like tax implications that they're trying to use various terminologies to define what they think that this is. But rest assured, it's going to be new global money and settlement, because it just represents energy. And I think energy is at the base layer of all interactions between life forms, at its core. Yep. So it's just really that simple. So yeah, what other books? I think Lynn's book does it. What I think Lynn's book does really well is it really goes to the base layer of first principle thinking on like, what is this energy exchange between participants? And it breaks out like, there is hard like physical commodities that can be used as a money layer, and then there's ledgers that can be used as money layers. If we all trust each other like really closely because we're family and we've been around each other a whole lot, ledgers work because like our social what can be compromised socially between us because we are so close-knit and we have to interact on a daily basis is what holds that ledger together so that nobody cheats. Okay. Yeah. But if I don't know you and you're on the other side of an ocean and I've got an exchange with you, well, now I want to start using commodity-based units to exchange with, because I don't have to necessarily interact with you ever again in the future. And so that's how these two different like money systems kind of evolve. And she talks about this in the book. She does a way better job than I can do talking it in just tons of detail. And so throughout history, you've had these two types of money kind of manifest themselves for two different reasons, which really kind of evolve around this idea of trust in social networks in the vicinity, the physical vicinity of these social networks. And now all of a sudden technology has allowed both of those two things to combine into one. And that's what's so fascinating about Bitcoin, is because it literally merges both of those two things together. And we've never been able to do that before.
It also explains why so many people struggle to understand it, because they're used to them being compartmentalized in completely different structures. And it's like, no, you guys don't get it. It's everything all at once. That's what's going on here. So you had mentioned that you appreciate how quickly veterans are picking up, kind of like the whole Bitcoin like concept and mantle. I take it that means you've had quite a few conversations with veterans over the Bitcoin topic then. How has that been going for you? Have you, cause like one thing that we've talked about and that I have issues with, particularly veterans that struggle or don't want to like come to the whole like Bitcoin conversation. One of the biggest things in particular that I've noticed is that they tend to view something that could be taking power away from the US dollar as mm-hmm. patently anti-American. Mm-hmm. And us girls here tend to agree that a lot of what like the monetary policy in the US has been doing and acting upon is actually strictly anti-American, because it's completely eroding the foundation of the country as far as like the middle and lower class. What like have you run into any specific like is that one of the major difficulties you've encountered with as far as like talking to veterans that don't want to do the whole Bitcoin thing, or do you have any of those conversations at all?
I think for most people that haven't spent a lot of time trying to understand all of this, right, that we're talking about, it's very, very difficult to step into a conversation, a superficial conversation, and really have somebody understand the nuances of like how profound this whole entire movement is. That's first and foremost. To the argument that you brought up, which I think is a very common sense, logical reaction that you would get to Bitcoin, which is, well, if Bitcoin's successful, that means the dollar is going to have less power in the world, which means that's bad for the United States. That person does not understand the tragedy of the commons. Tragedy of the commons is an idea. Back in the 1960s, there was a paper written on this. It's like farmland. If the five of us have a fixed plot of land, and we're trying to farm that land, each of us are incentivized to try to farm it as aggressively as possible, because we personally, individually benefit more by that action. But through that incentive structure of us to be basically selfish with this scarce plot of land, we destroy the yield that can come out of that land because we overproduce on it. Okay, and that's a really poor description. I'm sure a farmer is turning over in my description.
Well, I mean, it's actually what Rome did leading up to their collapse. So, I mean, it's relevant.
But this idea is an important one for people to research further, which is the idea of tragedy of the commons. What you have happening in the world right now is a tragedy of the commons with fiat currency. Every country is in a race to debase their currency, because when they do, what happens is they create an incentive for foreign currency to flow into that local region because the goods and services are cheaper. Okay. So you have the whole world racing to debase their currencies. And where this ends is a collapse of said currencies at a certain point. Okay. And we're getting very close to that point. The other thing that I would say is Bitcoin has a very similar dynamic. We can ban Bitcoin for that person. So what they're effectively saying is, we need to ban Bitcoin. We don't need to embrace it. We need to ban it because we need the dollar to be really strong and powerful. That's what that person's really saying. Okay. Yeah. And if they would take that stance in a world where they can't stop another country from using Bitcoin, it is impossible. Okay. What you're doing is you're saying, I refuse to run this race. I'm going to shoot myself in the foot, and I'm going to protest this race of these 10 entities running down the track, the 100-meter dash, and I'm not going to participate. Well, sir, you lost the race. You lost the race because this isn't a choice. Like, you don't have the choice to compete. It is moving out and it is going to happen whether you like it or not. And there's going to be countries that embrace it. And there's going to be countries that are scared and they're acting in fear and they're going to try to block it. And they're going to pay the price for that. So that would be my response to that person. What challenge you have by responding that way is they're going to say, well, you don't know that it's impossible to stop it. Right. Like, that's going to be their next go.
And then just bring up BitTorrent at that point.
It's going to be a very deep intellectual ongoing conversation because you know where it's going next. And then you got to go down the whole technological piece and explain that to them. And like, it gets very nuanced, but this is the difference between somebody who's ready for the conversation and one who's not. The person who's ready for the conversation is somebody who's looking around and saying, This is not in harmony with nature. Our actions as a government to just print more, let's send a billion there. Let's send a billion there. Let's pay for everybody's schooling. But all these people that went to the military, they still owe their service back. Let's send, right? If a person doesn't look at all those activities and say, something is really broke with these incentives, how is it going to remedy itself? How is that going to get resolved? If the person isn't in that frame of reference, in that frame of mind, they will never understand Bitcoin. The other person who will never understand Bitcoin is this type of person. The person who says, well, the big cats at the top, they're always just going to win. Like, you're not one of them. You're just going to be a loser, man. Like that person is destined to be a loser. And they're destined to not understand Bitcoin.
Yeah.
They won't ever
embrace. They're just embracing nihilism.
That's right. Because deep down at their core, they have a fundamental flaw. And what that fundamental flaw is the system's against me. I am a victim. I will always lose. They're not saying those things, but that's what their core actually is. Mm-hmm. They don't believe that life can get better. Okay. So you have to recognize very quickly, am I talking with a person that at their core is a pessimist and thinks that the whole world's against them? And because
blames the system, and yeah.
Because if you are, you're most likely wasting your time.
Yeah.
And I'm not, I don't want to discourage people from trying to bring those people along. But if you're talking to somebody who's 50 years old, and this is the way that this is kind of like the gist of how they respond. I'm sorry, the cognitive conditioning that's in their brain for 50 years is way stronger than you having a conversation with them for 30 minutes.
For sure.
Some really, really deeply ingrained neural pathways that good luck trying to break that up.
Yeah.
They need to get up on the mountain and spend a lot of time.
Yeah.
Breaking out that nonsense.
Like part of the conditioning in the military is there's no mountain too big. There's no obstacle too large that you can't overcome somehow, some way, with enough, focus and energy that you plow into the solution to get what you need to, the objective that you need to achieve. And that's why I think there's so many Bitcoiners that look at this and they're saying, oh my God, like this is crazy. Like, there's no way this can be real is the first reaction that I think everybody has. But like, if you put in the work to try to actually understand what this is, like, it's life changing.
Shane, did you want to ask me something?
Yeah. So we got a question from the audience. We got a few of them out there, but this one I thought was pretty interesting. If you're orange pilling a veteran, do you take a different approach? And if you do, why?
And this is no dig against veterans. If you're still actively serving, I think it's hard for some to get it simply because if you don't have disposable income, it's really hard to be a Bitcoiner. Just like matter of fact, like if each day you are going further and further in debt because you're not being compensated at a rate that outpaces your expenditures, like Bitcoin's really difficult for a person to wrap their head around and just by the pure math, right? So you could understand it all day long, but if you don't have the disposable income to plow into the units, into the digital energy units, then like it's because you're gonna have to sell them to offset your overconsumption. So I think that that's something that a lot of people don't want to talk about. It's something that you know, I get pushback online sometimes from people saying you could like that's an elitist kind of point of view. And I'm sorry, it's a mathematical point of view for me at least. I'm just like you have to get to a position where you are producing or you're receiving payment in excess of what you consume. If you can do that on a consistent basis, month after month, then you can store that energy and that value in Bitcoin.
Fantastic.
So Preston,
so I guess a little bit, I to answer your real question, which was, do I approach it differently? If I know the person doesn't have a substantial amount of disposable income, it is approached a little bit differently. I guess I talk about it more about like what's happening in the world, why it's transitioning to a new monetary system. And then hopefully in when they do get to a position where they have disposable income, then maybe they can start embracing this thing or this idea that they had heard about. You could actually make the argument that a person who doesn't have disposable income that starts to try to become a Bitcoiner could actually increase their volatility and pain in their life.
Yeah.
Yep. That's very true. I was gonna you actually kind of almost dovetailed into what I was gonna ask you. How are you feeling about the way things have progressed in the last couple of weeks? Like, I don't know how, like, if you guys saw that South Korea banned short selling of their banks, I believe, specifically. And then there's the whole like debt conversation as far as like the what's going on with yields and all that stuff. So if we could get like just like how you're thinking over the last couple of days, couple of weeks, I would appreciate it.
Yeah. So, I mean, the week to week for me is pretty slow paced. Like I look at a lot of the natural volatility in the markets and most of it is just noise. And there's not much signal in the week to week. I would say quarter by quarter, there's slight changes. Year by year is pretty much how I kind of look at major moves. If I was going to frame where we're at right now in these cycles and like what's happening in the markets is, you're starting to the retail mid cap, small cap businesses are getting crushed right now, like deeply crushed. The fact that you're seeing the yield curves uninvert themselves between the various durations tells me that you're about to see unemployment start to come back up. You're going to enter into what would be a recessionary period. How that's actually experienced versus previous recessions is still somewhat a mystery to me and anybody else. Hold on one second. I got to check my Traeger grill here. My wife was supposed to come home and turn that thing off, and I haven't heard the door open there. I just turned off the grill. Okay.
My Traeger grills, people.
Man, shit, right there.
Randy Kelly in the chat's like officers.
The other thing that I would say, so if unemployment is coming back up in, call it the coming 6 months, is what I would really expect unemployment to start kind of going much higher here in the coming 6 months to a year.
Yeah.
The thing that I think is going to be really difficult for people to kind of process is typically what you see at this point in the shorter term cycles, the 7-8 year cycles, is once unemployment starts to rip, the bond market starts to get bid. So you'd see all the yields come down across the whole duration of the curve. Still haven't fixed it. You'd see equities get pretty much destroyed. They would really start to sell off. You would go through what would be a semi creative destruction period where prices get priced so that equity gets shuffled around. That would be your next year to 2 years if we were going through what would be a normal cycle. Where on this what I think is about to play out here in the coming year to 2 years. And I really think that the reverse repo facility basically getting drawn down to zero, call it by January, February timeframe, is going to be when the fireworks maybe start going off, if I had to like guess.
Interesting. Okay.
What makes this cycle so much different is everybody can look at the math of like what they have to do with liquidity and how much debt is out there and the interest rates that they have to roll all this debt and the duration that they have to roll this debt, which is like short duration instruments, which they're already talking about. All of that really means that the bond market might behave very differently than what we are accustomed to. I think that, and I literally had a conversation with Luke Roman and some others, Jeff Booth and some others this morning. And I asked Luke what his thoughts were on that. And Luke agreed that he thinks initially that the bonds are going to bid initially, meaning the yields will go lower. But like shortly following that, at least on the long curve or the long duration bonds, like I don't know how they are going to continue to bid. Based on the math.
That is interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I just don't know how they could keep bidding, like, because everybody's going to be looking at this math and they're going to be looking at like just the sheer amount of liquidity that they got to, I mean, they got to drop tens of trillions, the 10 trillion at a minimum, like into this next like thing in the coming 2 years at a minimum.
And like how much did China step in to rescue us from 2008? Do you remember?
No, I don't know what that number would be.
Jordan and I were discussing this before the rest of you guys got up on here. Is the like that like it contributes to your thesis that like the recession that we're looking at is involving all of the superpowers in the Western nations. So like, who's gonna bid? Like to your point, who's gonna bid up these debt instruments when nobody has the free capital to do it?
Yeah, you have a major reshuffling of the petrodollar system. It's that simple. Like every country in the world totally understands like what's playing out. I mean, you literally had Xi and Putin like walking out of like some fancy hotel or something like that, and they're literally saying like the change that's upon us hasn't happened in 100 years. And like, that's why they're saying those things, is because the petrodollar system's failing. It's just a matter of fact. It's not even a surprise. Like nobody's going, I don't think anybody on like Wall Street or any of these like people that actually are heavily involved in finance would argue that point. The petrodollar system is failing. And it's a matter of like how that system, the bedrock of that system, gets reorganized, because the bedrock was very clearly the US Treasury market for the last 40 years.
Right. Yeah.
Like all savings, anybody who had massive amounts of savings, it got plowed straight into long duration bonds and, you know, 10-year treasuries and whatnot. And like the value of that kept up with the debasement that was happening on the dollar. And so it was a great way for people to store their retained earnings or their retained energy that the company or the individual produced, that at least had a large magnitude of buying power. That's all shifting. It's like a tectonic shift, earthquake of that bedrock. And so the question is what's going to be the new bedrock? Like, what are people going to store their long-term savings in? And, you know, what can they reasonably stuff that buying power into that they feel can't be debased or depreciated in value? And
man, it's so interesting. Glad you brought that up. Did you see that one interview with Mohammed El Aryan? That was mind blowing, man.
He's the former CEO of PIMCO.
Yeah.
Just put that in context, right? PIMCO is a fixed income monster. Okay.
Monster.
They were the leading manager of treasuries for the last 40 years. Mm-hmm. They were the experts of the former bedrock of finance, right? And you have that guy who was the former CEO who for all intents and purposes is one of the leading macro or financial minds on the planet. He's always on a panel Anytime that there's, you know, Larry Summers and these other people that are considered the elites of finance, and Muhammad's always on those panels, and he is talking about on CNBC, talking about why is the long end of the bond curve selling off? Well, it's because it's got major mathematical problems. And why is Bitcoin bidding? Well, because people are looking at it in Larry Fink's terms as quality, right? And right. So there's another one, Larry Fink, okay? What is BlackRock? BlackRock is another like epitome of the prior bedrock of finance and society, of all economic calculation, Larry, okay? Larry's literally calling Bitcoin hope. He's calling Bitcoin flight to quality. Like, like people that aren't paying attention to this, like they got to wake the hell up because,
oh yeah, these are signals, right? These are big signals,
big signals, massive signals.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing is that like, if they haven't been watching the space, they don't understand how aggressive of a shift like those two personalities are. Right. Yeah. So like, they're like, oh, they're just saying it like, whatever, like, you know, it's like, okay.
I can only imagine what's being discussed behind closed doors.
Oh yeah, how many years ago was it that he came out and he said, yeah, no, Bitcoin is never going to fly, and now he's got to do 180 degrees on national or international television. That's a huge deal for somebody like that to have to come out, you know, and eat some crow. That's a big deal.
It's a total green light for all of these all these little financial like mom and pop shops all over the country that can't afford to go out and do anything aggressive. All they've got to do is just perform at market returns or slightly worse. And then they're still going to have the portfolios under their control.
Yeah.
Like if the S&P does 14% and, you know, I'm managing a couple million bucks and I do 2% lower than that. And I slap my fees on it. Like those people probably aren't going to move their money. Okay. I cannot afford to go out and do anything that's considered like off tangent of the narrative of like what's a reasonable investment without assuming massive risk of everybody pulling their money out of my fund and going to the next guy that's marginally performing in the market. And by marginally, I mean underperforming S&P 500 probably by 1%. So, which is 98% of them. Like these aren't my stats. Look at Tony Robbins. He like went into a full dissertation on like the actual numbers of these people's performance. It's abysmal. this is a big shift. This is a big change because now you have Larry Fink basically greenlighting it and Muhammad greenlighting it.
Not just greenlighting it, but saying the bonds aren't doing so good and people are now doing Bitcoin. That was the transition. I'm like,
I think in the coming year, I think you're going to see the Fidelities. I think you're going to see BlackRock that come out and literally say, we think it's appropriate for people to have 1 or 2% exposure of Bitcoin in all portfolios. I think that's actually coming in the coming year.
Yeah. The analyst coverage, man, that's coming. That's going to, oh my gosh. I think, and
watch
that's,
out.
Yeah. We've been talking about this on Cafe Bitcoin a lot. It's like, you know, after they launch these things and the analysts start picking up coverage on it, oh my gosh, 1% allocation of what they're advising capital under management is a stupid amount of money.
Well, what is it? 70-80% of coins haven't moved in a year.
Yeah.
Right.
And you're talking, these guys advise something like $40 trillion worth of assets. 1%.
Yeah.
Allocation recommendation. Oh my gosh. That's material.
Very, very, very big deal.
Well, and the beautiful thing is the second and third order effects of this too, right? Is like once you start to see people going, yeah, you know, like in mainstream media, you should have 1%, 2%, you know, coming from BlackRock or Vanguard or the rest of these guys out there. And they're saying this, and then you start to have people start paying attention to Bitcoin that are in ETFs and they get pulled into the Bitcoin community. And they're like, what are you in? Oh, you're in BlackRock ETF. You need to get the fuck out of that, and you need to get into a hard position and with your own keys. The second and third order effects coming from that alone are going to be absolutely nuts.
Well, 1% is what, like 400 billion? So that would put us at a trillion, which would put us right back to all time. Now, like,
you're also not considering the multiplier effect, right?
Oh, no, I was going to get to that. Like I'm saying, it's like just from those guys putting in 1% and then the multiplier effect of all their peers and everybody looking to them rushing in like that.
No, that's interesting. That's not what I'm referring to. I'm referring to the fact that X amount of capital put into Bitcoin has an outsized effect on the actual market value because a 1% increase in the price of Bitcoin multiplied by the amount of sats like has an explosive factor on the actual market value of the Bitcoin. Preston, do you have any thoughts on that? Can you explain it better than
that? Yeah, it's real simple. So your volume that's actually showing you your spot price is a pittance of the actual like market cap that everybody always runs around quoting. Like there's a very small amount of Bitcoin that's changing hands, and that's what's determining that spot price that you're seeing. Like today, it's at 35,800. Right. That price is being determined by very few participants that are changing hands of dollars in Bitcoin. So if you're a billionaire and you want to take a billion USD and put it into the price of Bitcoin, like all at once, I think you'd probably move the market price today by $5,000-$6,000. But with just a billion, but in terms of the, it comes down to the pace that you do it. So if you insert that billion over 2 months, you probably wouldn't move the market price at all because you could slowly insert it. And so this is why you have over the counter desks. This is one of the things that Saylor, when he first came into Bitcoin, he could not believe how liquid this market is. His first buy, I want to say, was around $500 million. He inserted all of it in 2 weeks and didn't move the price. And he was blown away at that because most markets that you come in with $500 million into cannot handle that buy order without the price just getting just ripped.
Yep.
There's a couple different ideas kind of going on there, but the point is if you take a billion and you put it in and the market cap of Bitcoin is 500 billion, it doesn't become 501 billion. It's going to be a multiplier effect of that.
Yeah. Some people say it's up to like 118 times, depending upon how the math, how you do that.
Get out of here. That's crazy.
It depends on where you're at in the cycle. So like if you're in a bear market and everybody's selling and you're coming in and you're a buyer, like you're going to slow it down a bit, but like the price is still going lower, even though you brought a billion to the market. If you're coming in after the market has been beaten for a year and a half, like straight to the head for a year and a half, okay?
510 days of crawling across the desert with no water.
To the point where the person has been beaten to a pulp and they're down and they're just there, and you haven't had 70, I think the number 70-80% of the people that hold Bitcoin for more than a year, which I would say is the long-term hodler, they're not selling.
Right.
Which means they can continue to take the beatings, which means they are Teflon. Okay.
Yep.
This is a for people who don't trade markets and don't understand how markets move, they don't understand the magnitude of how important that is. But for people that maybe are in commodities and have traded markets their whole life and they would hear that stat, they're probably going out and researching this as intensely as they can because they know how insanely profound that idea is.
And they should. Like the whole concept of a finite supply is we've never seen it before as human beings ever.
Nope.
And it's very difficult to wrap the mind around. And I think even those of us in Bitcoin who've been in Bitcoin for a while probably are largely underestimating the long-term effect of that.
Well, you're taking a billion of USD at today's price out of the sell pressure come April. A billion per month less sell pressure is coming just from the halving event alone, combined with all these other things that we're talking about.
Yeah.
Not even talking the ETF, allowing people a turnkey way to buy it.
You said it. Now we got to talk about it. All right. Look, the price right now, $35,877. It's been a strong 24 hours. There are some people who believe that the authorized, if you look at the S1s, you notice that they were saying that the seed rounds were being purchased in October. Some of them.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that they need a lot of Bitcoin to seed the initial ETF. So I don't know how much of that has already been procured or whether any of it's been procured. But yeah, my understanding is that you don't need a lot to seed it.
So out of curiosity, what is your view? Like, what is going on right now with the price? What do you think is driving this?
If I was BlackRock and I'm looking at, if I'm BlackRock or Fidelity and I'm looking at Barry Silbert sitting on 620,000 Bitcoin, and I know what I know about markets, and I know that the market has been punished, and that all these crazy psychopaths aren't selling, I would be doing everything I can to buy those 620,000 Bitcoin from Barry as soon as I can at the with the valuation being based on this $35,000 price, to the point that I might even be trying to do things to keep the price down until I would close on those 620,000 Bitcoin. Right? Because if I can buy those 620,000 Bitcoin at this spot without moving the market, do this. Go out and try to buy 620,000 Bitcoin right now and don't move the price. Right? But if I can buy 620,000 out of Barry's treasury at this current spot and work out a deal and he's in legal trouble, and if I'm BlackRock, I can kind of wield around the DOJ like a weapon, right?
Yeah.
Right? Like, I would be wielding around that weapon. Not saying that I encourage these things. I'm trying to get in the mind of like how I think that they operate.
Adversarial thinking.
Yeah, that's how I think they operate. That's how I think they're thinking about it. And like, if you ever try to corner a market, you quickly realize that you go to the person who's sitting on a ton of inventory and you try to buy all of it all at once, even if the price is higher than the current spot. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that there's something there. let me say another thing. It wouldn't surprise me at all if BlackRock or Fidelity came out and said, oh, we bought the GBTC trust, all the Bitcoin in it, and then an ETF got approved a week later. That would not surprise me at all. In fact, I would say that's my base case.
That would be wild.
Yeah.
That would be my base case.
Quick announcements here. This is the Bitcoin Veteran Show. We've got a live feed going on YouTube and Facebook and Twitter. You can go out there and like and smash the notification bell to get the show notifying you. We've got some people in Twitter Spaces right now. One of those guys, I think you guys know pretty well, is Mickey Koss. Mickey, if you want to come off mute and ask your question, he's had his hand up there for a while. If you're out there and want to come up and ask a question, now is the time to do it. But Mickey, go ahead when you're when you come off mute. I know Gabe is out there as well. So Gabe, if you want to come up and ask, go for it. I think there's Mickey. No, Mickey's in the matrix somewhere. He's not talking. This is the problem with Twitter Spaces. You know?
Spaces every time.
Damn it, Elon.
Spaces will get you.
Well, if you figure it out, Mickey, come on back or type it in YouTube and we'll ask it.
While we wait for Mickey, Preston, can I just ask you how your back is feeling from carrying the weight of the show?
I'm not carrying any weight of anything, man. No, these are awesome questions. These are great questions because I think these are what most people are kind of curious about when it comes to like, how does this thing kind of progress through the next 6 months to a year? I'm obviously insanely bullish. I think next year at this time, I think we're going to be kind of blown away as to where we're at.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would be really exciting too. If this price appreciation really does start as everybody in the world starts to flood into Bitcoin while the rest of the markets are like shit in the bed, like that. Yeah. That would be. I can't imagine what that like. Let's just assume it's going to act like that way, because then everybody starts. That would literally be a 180 in a very short amount of time, where the market stops pricing Bitcoin as a risk asset.
Yeah,
right.
I like the comment there. Radio check.
Yeah, hey Mickey, we got you loud and clear. What's going on? Let's hear it, Mickey.
So we've been talking like macro and ETFs and all this stuff, but we got Veterans Day coming up. Pulled some data from the VA today, working on an article, and it was 16.8 suicides a day. And I think a common theme I see is Bitcoin's entering the Bitcoin space as a way to sort of regain that sense of purpose they lose when they leave the military. So I wanted to see if Preston had any sort of similar experience with, you know, linking Bitcoin to service and purpose and meaning in your life.
So this is how I would respond. I think that there's, it makes sense to me that a person could leave service and be pretty angry with what is happening with the government and all of it without getting political. Right. What I tell myself is whenever I entered service, Bitcoin didn't even exist. Like the only thing we knew was this world that was somewhat, and this has a very Western slant to the point of view, but what appeared to be a pretty stable functioning society, like when I went into service. And so like when I raised my hand to serve, I thought that, you know, you got to remember I'm 18 years old. I'm really young and don't know anything. And I still don't know anything, but, at that point in my life, I felt like I was doing something that was to add stability for what seemed to be these free and open market and free and open society morals and values. And that's why I joined the service, right? As we looked at this system that we were functioning under, like we were, as the military, we were the proof of work for the dollar, petrodollar system. That's what it was. Yeah. And when you look at that and you say, okay, well, Bitcoin didn't exist. This opportunity for global cooperation wasn't even technically feasible at that point, at that moment in time, but it is now. And so what am I doing to promote that? Right. So as the environment changed, as the conditions changed, I changed. And I can look at what's happening in the world from a very negative, dark lens. And if I do that, what I'm going to attract into my life is all those negative, dark things. But if I choose to focus on what I can do to make it a better place and what I can do to usher in this abundance that this will bring, because through cooperation that can't be manipulated, I think that I don't even think we can comprehend the abundance that it'll bring to the world. The transition's going to be tricky. It's going to be painful for a lot of people. It just is. But I think on the other side of that is something that is way more profound than we could ever imagine. And so I guess when I look at the question, Mickey, and kind of like if there's veterans out there that are struggling, heck, one of my roommates, he committed suicide coming back, right? This is very real for veterans. Like there isn't a person that didn't serve that isn't impacted in some kind of way with a story like that, okay? And you just have to try to be that person that directs them and points them to how this can actually be an amazing, beautiful outcome that points them towards abundance as opposed to focusing on the pain of the past.
Mm-hmm. Great answer. Gabe is out there in the audience as well. And wanted to give him a second. He's been down in El Salvador at Adopting Bitcoin, representing Bitcoin veterans down there. Gabe is also the founder of Operation Bitcoin and Skillshare program. So Gabe, go ahead, man.
Buenas noches. Can you hear me all right?
Si, senor.
Good. I'm sitting in a layover right now in Miami, just coming back from El Salvador. Amazing trip. Something, first of all, Preston, thanks for being here tonight. Appreciate you making the time and sharing your insights with us.
Thanks.
So, spent a few days down there, and something that really got my attention was the number of veterans that I ran into that I hadn't known yet. Some from the U.S. military, some from other militaries across the world. And the amazing thing was that not only were they engaged in Bitcoin, but they're also building things within the Bitcoin ecosystem. And I mean, Preston, obviously you have built something amazing within Bitcoin. And what type of guidance would you pass down to other veterans specifically who are beginning to build things within Bitcoin?
I would first say you got to know yourself. So everybody has different skill sets, even though we have this common, I would say the common thing that comes out of the military is you are just an executor and an operator. That comes inherent through that type of training. And I think just the type of person that's attracted to serve in the military. So like that is typically an inherent asset of the person. But each person has like a different asset that they possess. Like for me, when I was in the service, like I kind of had this financial interest in this engineering background. So like those are assets for me to personally transition into something else after military service. Everybody has their thing. And you just have to know how to talk about what your personal assets are to that business or that employer that you're going to next. The next thing is if you want to, you obviously want to go to Bitcoin because you see it as this hope to the world moving forward. So find a company that kind of matches your natural skills, and most importantly, that matches your cultural that's a good cultural fit for you. Because just like in the military that had its own culture, these businesses have their own culture as well. And so you really need to do a deep dive on those businesses before you reach out to them and try to seek employment. And then like once you get your interview, you got to go out there and you got to really kind of sell those assets, those personal assets that you bring to the table and let them know like how you can benefit those companies. And for any companies that are listening, I can tell you, having led many soldiers while in the military, these people are go-getters. They need little guidance. If you tell them to go do this with very little guidance, they're a message to Garcia. I'm sure everybody's read it, right? Like, and if people in corporate America, if you haven't read it, like go read it and you'll understand like what you're getting when you get a military person in your organization, because they need very little guidance. You can just kind of point them in a direction and they're going to run. They're going to go hard. And if they're going in the wrong way, you might want to catch them before they get too far down the path, because they're going to be moving out. but that's an asset for employers. So yeah. for both audiences, for employers and for military that are looking to transition, don't sell yourself short. What you bring to the table is you are a hard worker and you are an operator. And let me tell you, there's a lot of shortage of that type of mindset in corporate America.
That was another really good answer. That was worthy of the pause for effect, I think.
Gabe gave you the thumbs up on Twitter Spaces there.
Hell yeah, and one of you guys mentioned something a minute ago, but I mean, you're working like an NCO in here, Preston. So
I take that as a compliment, sir.
It definitely is.
We've hit that magical time where there's only about 15 minutes left in the show, and I love talking Bitcoin. I love talking the veteran side of it and seeing how amazingly well read and smart people are that come on the show. There's also an aspect of fun that we like to have where we get to know each other a little bit better and really kind of see what's going on. What we ask of a lot of our guests is, what are some of your favorite stories? Maybe the funny, like practical jokes, maybe an instance you had, maybe at West Point, possibly deployed. Just, this is an adult show, so you can, feel free to just, throw up that freak flag and let it go. Yeah, I'm sure you will, but yeah.
Okay, I don't know. Were we recording when we first started talking?
Yeah, we were a little bit.
Were people hearing that conversation?
Yeah, but you don't have the audience now.
That's changed.
People in there, but yeah.
Well, there's more to the shoe shining story, and I think I write about this in the book. So this guy, like I'm a cadet, right, and I'm in charge of a platoon of about 40 cadets, and this one guy, he's just, he would not shine his shoes. It was just terrible. Like he was, it was this disaster. So, at night while he was sleeping, and I mean, this shows you how much of a psychopath I've always been. At night, I wake up like 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. I go to his room and I take one of his shoes. Okay. I come back to my room and I mean, it's everybody's sleeping. It's like psychopath Preston there. I light the shoe polish, the Kiwi on fire. I get it. Like I put it all over the shoe. I then take the shoe into the freezer. I freeze the shoe. I go back like 15 minutes later, the Kiwi's all like frozen on there pretty good. I start like working the shoe. I do this for like an hour and a half. I mean, I polished the living hell out of this shoe. It looked like glass. I go back 3 in the morning, whatever it was ridiculous. I put the shoe back under his bed right next to the other, you know, shoe that looked like he shined it with a candy bar. And, you know, formation, we go to PT, I don't remember, 5:30, wake up, 5 a.m. wake up, whatever it was for PT. We're out there. I'm smoked because I am so tired from doing this the night before, right? We get to the breakfast formation. This kid shows up with the one shoe, like immaculate, immaculate. The funniest thing to me was he had two sets of shoes, right? So like, if I was smart, I would have hid the other set so that like it forced him to wear this shoe. But dummy me, I didn't do that. But he still wore the really good
shoe. Oh my God.
The kid still wore this shoe that looked like glass, and he wore the candy bar shoe like next to it down to the formation. So he comes down and he's just standing there and like, I get down and like my, the sergeants that work for me, the squad leaders, they are, I mean, everybody's just huddled around the upperclassmen. They were like all huddled around this kid. And I kind of walk around the bend and I see them just going to town on this kid. They're crushing him. And I walk up and I said, what's going on here? What's going on? And they're like, you know, cadet so-and-so, he is making a mockery of us. He knows how to shine his shoes. Look at his right shoe. It looks like glass. He's shoving this in our face. Like he knows what he's doing. And I walk over and I am just like, what the hell is this, right? Like, come up here, stand in front of the platoon, show everybody the mockery that you're making of us with this shoe. Oh my God. Like I have no idea how I had that much energy back in that day to go do something so stupid.
Sounds like you were really pissed off.
But I was having fun.
No, I was gonna say that sounds like you were just having fun. Like,
but that's motivated. You know, you get up at 1 o'clock in the morning, you spend 2 hours shining this guy's shoe. That's motivation, right?
Oh my God.
Dude. Well, I also imagine like, okay, you're going to West Point. You don't have like, you're not going out Thursday night drinking, I would imagine.
No, there was nothing. There was no other way to entertain yourself.
Yeah. And so it was like, that's, you know, that's what I got to do in college going through. That was, is like,
that was our,
while I was going through ROTC, which was much easier.
That's a great way to put it. Like, it's hard for me to even put myself in the mindset of like, why would I do that back then? But you're right. It was, there was no other way to entertain yourself. And so like, that's how I like,
you were still a young dude that like didn't need sleep. Like all the dudes in the chat, have a good time.
All the dudes in the chat are rolling on the floor. Like, damn hilarious.
Anybody low time preference thinking to do all that work at 2 a.m. and then get the reward later on in the day.
Proof of work, man.
Oh my God. And then all the upperclassmen that worked for me, they were just like, dude, you're nuts. Like, you're that's like, yes, I am. You're right. I am.
Don't slight him. That's what they learned.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's pass it around. We're gonna start closing remarks. Any order you guys want to go in.
I think Alex has something he needs to get off his chest.
Uh-oh.
Oh. All right, just real quick. So we did this thing, Preston. I'm gonna extend an invitation to you on Shane's behalf. I'm just inviting people up to Shane's property right now. So we did this thing a couple, 3 weeks ago where Shane does this thing called the Brave Experience. And it was originally designed as a thing for guys who have PTSD, come back from combat, just as a way to kind of get through that stuff and to make things right with themselves and however they needed to do that. But anyway, it's a really cool thing, and it's expanded quite a bit. Basically, you go up on the mountain behind Shane's property. I'm not going to say where it is, but it's a very special thing. And if you have the time and the bandwidth to do it, I would highly recommend it. It is life-changing. And it's becoming a thing where, like, this whole Bitcoin veterans thing is turning into a huge movement. Like, it's the acceleration on this thing is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Guys who, like you said, some of them are a little maybe disenchanted with what they thought they were going to get out of being in the military, finding out that it's not really what they thought it was going to be. Maybe even finding out that what they thought they were fighting for, they weren't really. And this is just a way for guys to re-engage on a mission with purpose. A lot of the guys I think that joined are have like a sheepdog kind of heart. You know, they're protectors of people by nature. There's no better way to protect freedom and people than Bitcoin. So like they get this thing. So it's all kind of interwoven together. But I just wanted to shout out the Brave Mission because it's a big deal.
And I am in. Like that's not even a hard one. Like,
well, there's
I say yes to a whole lot of things that I actually don't really want to do. So like this one's easy. I want to do that.
I mean, he's getting up at 1 o'clock in the morning. He's halfway there already.
Come on, man. I used to shine shoes at 1 a.m. of like they weren't even my shoes.
I gotta tell you, Preston, the amount of laughs that we had in a 36-hour period doing this was that alone was life changing, besides the experience itself.
Yeah,
I love it. I'm in.
All right, we're gonna throw it around the horn. That's awesome. I'm thank you, Alex and Preston and the rest of the guys for making this thing bigger and bigger and doing all the work. Jordan, Mike, Alex, anything close up?
Oh, I've asked plenty of questions tonight. I'm satisfied. I don't think I need to ask Preston anymore.
I've got one thing. The next episode is going to be episode 21, and I'm just going to throw it out there that maybe right now we're going to be talking to Operation Bitcoin, aka Gabe Lord, about his experience and everything that we're doing with Operation Bitcoin, which is another mission we're doing. Unless somebody wants to come on and be that scarce resource that is episode 21, if you want to fund Operation Bitcoin, I think they will let you take their place. So I'm just going to throw that out there.
That was a good plug.
Alex?
Yeah, no, I said my piece. I just want to say thanks to Preston for being on the show, man. Like what you've done with your podcast and just the impact that you've made in the Bitcoin ecosystem in general is admirable. And I just want to thank you for it. It's awesome.
Thank you, Alex. Appreciate it's been a pleasure getting to know you at a couple different places that we've met. Yeah.
Preston, anything you want to say before we wrap this guy up?
No, just I guess I do want to say one thing. You have to pay attention to your focus. Like where you focus your energy is what you're going to create in this world. And I think that when I look at a lot of veterans, I'm not saying a lot of them are negative or positive. That's not what I'm trying to push forward. And this advice is for veterans or just anybody. You have to curate what you allow to the data packets that flow into this thing. And when you do that, and you curate it in a way that you know you are here for a reason, to win, to be productive, to make this world a better place, more efficient, to make relationships better. And you know that to your core, and that you're here to help others just as much as you're here to help yourself. And you start focusing upon that and what gifts you can kind of provide to this environment that you're operating in. Let me tell you, your life is just a life of abundance. Like it's just a blast. You're going to have fun. And so The thing I would tell people to really focus upon, first of all, Bitcoin, like you got to have that. That one's obvious. But then what else in your life are you allowing to flow into your brain? And what are you doing to curate that so that you can produce the outcome that you want? And where are you sailing the ship? Right. I think there's a lot of people, and this is a Jim Rohn idea, is like they're on a sailboat and they can control the rudder and they can control the sail, but they can't control the wind. Okay. You have to adjust to that wind. And most importantly, you have to know where the hell you're sailing that thing. And I think when people go on social media and they're allowing this boat to just kind of blow around in the water, and like there's no real destination. And until you curate the information that's coming into your mind, you're not setting a destination. You don't even know where you're going. So you have to be very choosy as to like, what is that destination that you're sailing to? There are controls on the boat. Don't tell yourself there aren't controls, because there's a lot of people that are saying this wind is just blowing too hard. The wind is blowing in the exact opposite direction of the place I'm trying to sail. Well, then tack into the wind. You can sail upwind. You got to tack into it. And the only way you can do that is with the rudder and the sail. So like, find what your rudder and your sail is. Stop saying that you can't navigate the winds, because you can, and select a destination and curate all the other noise out of your life so that you can have this life of abundance. And when I look at people that come out of the military, they have so much potential, they have so much energy, and they just got to channel it into the right areas and select what that destination is and know that they do have a rudder and a sail to navigate their environment. And let's make it. I know that was a very Navy centric kind of example, but
Randy Kelly.
I deeply apologize.
I knew he was Navy at heart.
You are very ready for the mountain. I got to tell you that.
Yeah, I got to say, man, I'm excited, and I'm not going to try to, you know, outdo what Preston just said. Bravo, sir. And just hats off to this entire group for making things like this happen. If you are out there and you haven't found a mission, you haven't found purpose, you haven't found your thing in this world, maybe you don't know how to attack or guard this OODA loop in between your ears, man, this is a group for you. It's got a ton of people in here that I consider not only leaders, but brothers in this fight. And to recapture that purpose, that understanding, that meaning and passion for life, that we understand, especially here in America, as liberty and freedom and self-sovereignty, get a hold of us. You can email us, you can tweet at us, you can get in our DMs. We will add you to the groups. We're expanding so much now that we have regions inside of the U.S. We are taking on internationals at this point. And this is here for anybody and everybody. It's not just, you know, the veterans, it's for their families, for everybody that they touch, and, working through everything that, you know, we need to work through in terms of communication protocol as a species, what Bitcoin is all about. So, Preston and everybody else out there, thank you guys for making time. Jordan, Mike, and Alex and Gabe and, everybody, thank you guys very much for hanging out with us again. Until next week, 7 PM Wednesday, this is Bitcoin Veterans. We will see you then. Peace.
Damn, that was good.
That was good.
Weird, fellas.